the God of the Bible. He reveals himself. In one of his revelations, he said, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth below, or in the water under the earth." You shall not have other gods before me. That if there was a plurality of gods, if there are many different legitimate gods, and they just have different specialties, then a particular god might want his domain and try to pull everybody over to his side in a selfish sense. But if there's only one God, one supreme, one sovereign God, then it's not a matter of worshiping other gods in the sense of true gods. It's only a matter that people might worship what they build up to be a god, what they make to be a god. And thus the true God becomes a jealous God, a zealous God, because he is the true God. And the Old Testament is filled with this call to the nation of Israel and to others to recognize that Yahweh is the only God. That seems so distant, the whole concept of the Old Testament. Israel being a nation led through the wilderness to a promised land and people being driven out and an ark and a covenant and a temple. And a God that is jealous, a God that is always pulling people back and saying, "I'm the true God, don't worship those idols." And we live in a world where there aren't idols in that regard. And so it seems so distant. But then you think of it from a different perspective, and you think today, what would be the reaction, or what is the reaction to a God that is a jealous God? A God that says, "I am the true God." Or people that proclaim there is a true God. See, we live in a world that says, "Oh, there are lots of gods. Don't be claiming you have the only God, or that your God is the only God." That's not good. That's not healthy. And so this past week, because of some sinful acts of some people that are labeled being on the right, then the right extremist becomes the word, you know, that all these right extremists. And it appears that you're a right extremist if you hold any views contrary to what somebody on the left might hold. What makes you a right extremist? Not that you hold similar beliefs. So you can be in the Ku Klux Klan and you can be a right extremist and you can be an evangelical believer that would write a letter of protest about abortion and be a right extremist. Can you imagine what would be said to Elijah or about Elijah? If Elijah was alive today, if Elijah was on the scene today, he would be viewed as an extremist, a right extremist. He should be on the terror list. He's the one that we should be afraid of. But why? Because he does acts of terror, or because he believes in a sovereign God? The account we'll look at today is at the beginning of 2 Kings. And it is a statement, once again, that there is only one true God. There's only one true God. But as we look in 2 Kings, it is one of these unique books that originally there was not a 1 and 2 Kings. In the Hebrew Bible, there was Kings. But the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, when they came to this, they just viewed it was too long, and so they divided it in half. And our English Bibles have followed the same tradition, so we have 1 Kings and 2 Kings. But there's not an introductory. There's not some break in action that makes any sense in terms of it being a new book. In fact, to even get the setting for how we are to understand the beginning of 2 Kings, we need to look back at 1 Kings. Verse 51 at the end of 1 Kings 22. Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel in Samaria in the 17th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. And he reigned 2 years over Israel. He did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father and in the way of his mother and in the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. So he served Baal and worshipped him and provoked Yahweh, God of Israel, to anger according to all that his father had done. So Ahab, you'll recall, died at the end of that in 1 Kings. And his son comes to power. And 2 Kings, even though it's a continuation of 1 Kings and it's just somewhat in the middle, as in the English book, or in our English Bibles, it begins with a most unusual story. And Kings has a lot of unusual stories. Anytime Elijah is connected with anything, it seems to be unusual. But this account is really a little different, and it's one of these that people react to. And they see Elijah as that right-wing extremist. I remember hearing on TV a very liberal pastor teaching on this chapter, and when he comes, he's talking about Elijah, and he's going, you know, he's just a religious zealot. And Elijah, once again, is the bad guy. He, you know, his sermon that day was against religious zealots. And Elijah's who you need to watch out for, because he's a religious zealot. It's so intriguing in this that you draw the conclusion that he's a religious zealot because of the miracle that occurs. But yet you dismiss the miracle. Because if you acknowledge there's a miracle, then you're involving God. So you dismiss the miracle didn't really occur, but because of the miracle, Elijah's the bad guy. It's kind of this circular argument that we go through where we decide we don't like something. See, our nation doesn't like the idea that there is a sovereign God. There's one God. Because by definition, if there's one God, you should be subservient to Him. If there's a plurality of God, then you pick and choose. The account begins in 2 Kings, having already established that Ahaziah is a bad king, an evil king following in the steps of his father and mother who were Baal worshippers. But he's on the scene now. He's the king, will be the king for 2 years. And in his reign, it says, now Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. And Ahaziah fell through the lattice in his upper chamber, which was in Samaria, and he became ill. So he's walking around somewhere on the balcony, and the balcony gives way. It's one of those things that you probably have a thought from time to time. I remember a couple of weeks ago when we were in South Dakota and I was on this dam, and it's got this metal railing there, and it's the ravine below, it's pretty far down. And you're sitting there holding that railing, kind of like, you know, did they really know what they're doing when they put this up? I mean, did anybody really test this thing? Or did somebody just put up a piece of metal and screw in a little bolt and said it's safe and we go along trusting it? Well, evidently somebody put up a railing and the king came along and put his hand on the railing and leaned out and he fell. And he's hurt. And he's hurt severely. The kind of injury that's not just, is his leg going to heal, but is he going to recover or is he going to die? So he sent messengers and said to them, "Go inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover from this sickness." He wants to know, am I going to live? But who does he ask? Does he say, find a prophet of Yahweh? No. He says, let's find out from Baal whether I'm going to live or not. But the angel of the Lord said to Elijah the Tishbite, "Arise, go up to meet the messengers of the king of Samaria and say to them, 'Is it because there is no God in Israel that you are going to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron?'" I mean, there's a disdain in this question. Why are you going to inquire of Baal rather than Yahweh? Why would you do that? Is that really what you're about? And the question really isn't addressed to these guys, but it's addressed to the king. But notice throughout this account that the writer here mentions in verse 2 who we're talking about, Ahaziah. But his name isn't mentioned again until the very end. It's just referred to as he. And it's in such a way at times you all have to be careful to even figure out who we're talking about. I believe the purpose of this type of writing is to make us so clear that we are not talking about the king. The story is not about the king. The story is about Yahweh. You know, this type of historical narrative is not about history per se, though it involves history. It's about Yahweh revealing himself, so telling us who he is. It's not an account so we can understand something about the kings of Israel. It's not an account that gives us character information about Elijah, even though it does give us that. It is the opportunity to reveal who Yahweh is. So Yahweh has this question. Are you going to go ask this god of another country, this Baal god that your mother brought here, are you going to go ask of him because there's no god in Israel? "Now therefore, thus says Yahweh, you shall not come down from the bed where you have gone up, but you shall surely die." And Elijah heads out. We see in these, as we continue in the next few verses here, we just see this disdain God has for this idea of gods and idols. Verse 5, "When the messengers returned to him, he said to them, 'Why have you returned?' They said to him, 'A man came to meet us and said to us, Go, return to the king who sent you, and say to him, Thus says Yahweh, is it because there is no God in Israel that you are sending to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? Therefore you shall not come down from the bed where you have gone up, but you shall surely die.' And he said to them," that is, the king said, "'What kind of man was he who came up to meet you and spoke these words to you?' They answered him, 'He was a hairy man with a leather girdle around his loins.' And he," that is the king, said, "'It is Elijah the Tishbite.'" Remember, Ahab would respond to Elijah when he'd hear about Elijah. He'd say, "Oh, my enemy, my old enemy." And now the son has the same thing. Who is he? What's he look like? What did he sound like? Oh. Elijah, my dad's enemy. It was Elijah. You know, this section, we see that Yahweh detests. There's a disdain for false gods and idols. And as you look at the various components that we see in these verses, there's a jealous God. You can almost inappropriately say there's an intolerant God. You look at the first commandment, he says, You shall not have other gods before me. You shall not have idols. We also see an ingrained idolatry here. Ahaziah has grown up in a family where his mother and his father, they went after Baal. His mom was the queen of the Baal worship. And there's a consistency in his belief system. You know, he worships Baal. But we also see a stubborn and foolish idolatry here. Faced with death, Ahaziah fails to embrace a sobriety of faith, but instead just hangs on to this impotent God. I mean, if he just looked at the history of his father, you'd say, okay, and perhaps, you know, within his lifetime, we think that he was old enough to clearly remember that on Mount Carmel, Elijah was there, and all the prophets of Baal. And they prayed and they prayed and they prayed, and Baal couldn't produce any fire. Elijah prayed, and Yahweh sent fire. There's nothing in his lifetime to have shown that Baal is a god that can produce. There was a drought, and he couldn't save him from the drought. But Yahweh was the God that caused and the God that relieved the drought. But there's a stubbornness here, a foolishness in this idolatry. He just continues with it. There's also a severe judgment. We see twice in this in these verses 2 and 6, and then also again in 16, that Ahaziah will be bedridden and death-stricken. That there's a judgment because he seeks false gods. His inquiry of Beelzebub implies that he either sees Yahweh as a non-existent God, he doesn't really exist, that he's irrelevant, that he's, there's no real relevance to him, or that he's inadequate, that he's not capable. Something he sees in Yahweh just dismisses him. And that's the essence of any and all idolatry, that you just dismiss the true God. One writer states, Yahweh is furious, not tolerant. Holy, not reassuring. Loving, not nice. But there is love in his fury. He won't let you walk the path of idolatry easily. His mercy litters the way with roadblocks. And that's what we see here. Now, we could read into this, knowing other passages of God, that God didn't just strike the king dead. There's this warning, and this warning, and this warning. What we never see is a response by the king to Yahweh. If he would have responded, would grace have been there? Everything else in the Bible suggests there would have been grace. And there would have been salvation. There would have been forgiveness. But he's warned and he's warned. So if we extrapolate from that, we might say, as this writer said, that if you walk toward idolatry, God always interjects. God's always putting a roadblock there. God's always putting up a warning sign. God's always trying to pull us back. And he even did it with a king that totally dismisses him. One that is totally against God. But isn't that who God is? Isn't that what it tells us in Romans? That while we were his enemies, he sent Christ. It doesn't say that we had no interest in him. We would not pursue him at all, and yet he pursued us. Well, the next section, we see Yahweh defends his servant. The king is very furious. You can imagine he sends messengers, go over and find out what this God's got to say to me, and they come back saying, well, Elijah's intervened and told us this and sent this warning back to you. So he's not too happy about that. Verse 9, then the king sent to him a captain of 50 with his 50. And he went up to him, and behold, he was sitting, that is Elijah, on the top of a hill. And he said to him, O man of God, the king says, come down. Elijah replied to the captain of the 50, "If I am a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50." Then fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. So he, that is the king, again sent to him another captain of 50 with his 50, and he said to him, "O man of God, thus says the king, come down quickly." Elijah replied to them, "If I am a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. Then the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Now see, that's where that, I made reference earlier to the pastor that said Elijah's a religious zealot. It's because of this. He is so ingrained that he is right that he would consume these guys in fire and consume them. The question I had at that time when I first heard it was like, wait a minute, where'd this fire come from? You don't want to talk about the miracle of this fire. He's a religious zealot. Now, if he'd been a religious zealot and he pulled out his knife or his sword and ran out there and he killed all 50, okay, he's a religious zealot perhaps. There's a fire from heaven comes down and consumes these guys. Where'd the fire come from? How did Elijah produce a fire? And say, he threw fire bombs? I mean, what are you going to extrapolate to make this? But see, this is what happens with the Bible. People go along and use certain parts to tell a story, but you dismiss the supernatural. You dismiss everything that points that there's a true God, and you look at the individuals and you say, oh, they're a right-wing extremist. No, Elijah prayed. The God of heaven responded. So what was the intent of the king and his soldiers? Well, if you want to say, well, he just wanted to have a friendly conversation. He just wanted to find out. Now, exactly, this is kind of hearsay. My soldiers came back and said that you said, but I want to really know exactly what did Yahweh say? Well, if you really think that's what was going on, then you're just intent on misreading the passage. Why would he send for him? Because he's angry. Here's a king that his servants were turned around by Elijah. Elijah's been a thorn in the side of his father, and now he sends men out to get Elijah. This is not a friendly encounter. Who's to blame for all this? Is Elijah really to blame? Notice the soldier comes. The first one, the first captain, he says in verse 9, "O man of God, the king says, come down." O man of God, we're recognizing something about you, that you're a prophet, that you respond to God, that you've got this inside track to God, and I'm commanding you in the name of the king to do something. Elijah does what? He prays. If I'm a man of God, you say I'm a man of God. If I'm a man of God, then let God prove that I'm a man of God. So if you're going to blame somebody here, it's got to be Yahweh. Yahweh's the one that sent the fire. Then you look at the method. What's the method? Well, it's the same as it was on Mount Carmel. Fire comes down. Is that just accidental? Has God just happened to forget and use the same thing? Or is this very intentional? It is a clear reminder. Oh, remember when Baal and the Yahweh sacrifices were set up on Mount Carmel? And the Baal prophets prayed and prayed and prayed. And Elijah prayed. Who turned out to be the true God? Here we have a similar setting where they're going out after Baal. And Yahweh intervenes. And it's with fire. It's a reminder that Yahweh is the true God. Now, does God always provide for His witnesses? No. Not in the sense of absolute deliverance, physical deliverance. Remember, while Elijah was away in protective places during the 3 years of the drought, that Jezebel rounded up the prophets of Yahweh and had them killed. God didn't deliver those prophets, but He provided for Elijah. In this situation, He's providing for Elijah. A book on martyrs in the twentieth century tells us that a Baptist preacher in the Soviet Union in 1920 was taken in for interrogation and punishment, and he said, "I don't fear to die, for I shall be going home to the Lord. If He has decided my hour hasn't come, you can't do any harm here." It kind of sounds like Daniel's three friends. You know, you can do what you want, but if God's decided, He's able. I don't know what He's going to do, but if He wants to, He's able. This guy says, "Hey, you know, if you kill me, I'm going to the Lord. I'm going home. But if it's not my time, you're not going to be able to kill me." Well, this infuriates this military guy here. "And I'll prove to you that your God will not deliver you out of my hands." He pulls out his revolver, and it says that he tries to fire it three times. Another guy standing there goes, "He's a Baptist. Can't you see God is fighting for him?" And they let the guy go. Now, other people were martyred during this time period. So it's not one of these things you can claim that, you know, based on this passage, God always delivers. But it's like Daniel's friend said, He is able. And throughout history, He's shown that. Elijah here is being protected by a sovereign God. Well, we also see here that Yahweh responds to submission. There's a third captain. How would you like to be the third captain? You're sitting around in the palace. The word comes back and you see the king. And the king says, "I want..." And you're over there going, "Don't call my name. Don't call me." And he goes, "Yeah, I really want this task. Let me run up there for you, captain, and go, or for king, let me run up there and say, 'Elijah, come back down here,' and let me get consumed and come back as barbecue." So anyway, so again, he sent the captain of a third 50 with his 50. When the third captain of the 50 went up, he came and bowed down on his knees before Elijah. What a difference. And he begged him and said to him, "O man of God, please let my life and the lives of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. Behold, fire came down from heaven and consumed the first two captains of the 50 and their 50s. But now let my life be precious in your sight." The angel of the Lord said to Elijah, "Go down with him. Do not be afraid of him." So he arose and went down with him to the king. He knelt, he pleaded, he trembled, and he lived. I've become very interested in watching this Caesar Millan on the National Geographic Channel, The Dog Whisperer. And on the way to South Dakota recently, I listened to an audio book of his... very interesting. He's not a trainer. He doesn't teach dog obedience. His, quote, mission in life is to rehabilitate dogs and train people. But it's about making dogs where they're livable, you know, in situations, dogs that are having problems. If you ever watch his show, it's very, very interesting. But it's all, you know, he talks about a calm assertiveness. But it's all, you know, his whole thing is about these dogs' energy, and he works with them in the sense that they have to be submissive before you do things. And you know, this the other day I was watching one. This lady's having problems with these labs, and she's trying to take them for a walk. And he's, you know, explained to her that when she goes to put the leash on, she cannot put the leash on until they're totally submissive. As long as they're excited, she cannot put the leash on. Because she's rewarding them. You have to wait until they are submissive, until they're calm and submissive. You know, that's what you're seeing here. is the first guy goes up, "Oh, you man of God, get down here." Wiped out. There's no submission. There's an arrogance. They may be saying man of God, but there's no respect to him as a man of God. He's just a man of a God. But this third guy shows up and he says, "Hey, I'm here because I have to be here. I understand that you're a man of the God. I understand that all you have to do is say the word and your God has the authority, the power to send fire and consume us. Count our lives as precious." I mean, there is this sense of submission by their stance to sit down, to kneel, to be submissive. And it's a totally different outcome. See, when you look at this story in its totality, you don't see Elijah as the religious zealot. What you see is that there's a true God and that there are some that approach him with a disdain. There's no recognition. There's no intent to recognize him as anything. He doesn't exist. You might use the terms, but the third guy approaches differently. In the last verse, and in what might even be called an epilogue, and we see that Yahweh judges. Verse 16, "Then he said to him, 'Thus says,'" that is Elijah saying to the king, "'Thus says the Lord,'" and once again, which repeated, "'because you have sent messengers to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, is it because there is no God in Israel to inquire of his word?'" See, that's still the question. Why is it that you inquire of a foreign God instead of Yahweh? Is there no God in Israel? Well, yeah, there are gods in Israel. There are idols in Israel, but it's back down. Is Yahweh God? Do you recognize Yahweh as God? Well, what's been proven throughout this chapter is no, you don't. And there's never a response. Well, there's always a response by the king, but there's never a response of submission. The only submissive person in the whole chapter is the one captain. And so the pronouncement comes. "Therefore you shall not come down from the bed where you have gone up, but shall surely die." His question is, I want to know what Baal has to say. I want a God of authority to tell me whether I'm going to live or not. And Yahweh says, "Well, I can tell you that. You don't need to send outside. My question is, why do you want to send outside instead of asking me? Isn't there a God of Israel?" Almost in the sense of an epilogue, 17 and 18 says, "So Ahaziah died according to the word of the Lord, which Elijah had spoken, and because he had no son, Jehoram became king in his place." And then once again, aren't the rest of the Acts written elsewhere? Because Kings is historical record, but it's not of all the actions. It's about the spiritual heritage. What spiritual heritage did he have? And he had no true spiritual heritage. His parents raised him to worship foreign gods and idols, and he was consistent to that. Even in the face of death, he couldn't comprehend that there was a true God. You know, that's very much where our nation is. And we're going to hear, I believe, more and more of this sense of right-wing extremist. And we are all going to be grouped into that right-wing extremist, even though you would totally abhor anything the Klan would do. That you would think that it's totally wrong and a sin against God, a sin against mankind, to murder someone, regardless of what legal practice they were conducting. But yet, when you believe in one God, Elijah, A religious zealot? No. As the text says, as the king recognized, in a certain sense, a man of God. The question is not just a man of a God, a man of Yahweh. And Yahweh has the ability to intervene whenever he chooses. He doesn't always choose to intervene in time in a way that displays that type of authority. But he does intervene. And I think there is that intervention, as the one writer said, that he throws out roadblocks, he throws out signs, he throws out things in our path to point us back. And God would do that for a king that grew up under parents that despised Yahweh. And he's a king that never did anything except to provoke Yahweh. And God would still send roadblocks. What would he do for his children? But yet the question always comes back to us, how do we respond? Do we respond differently? When God's calling us back, when the challenges are coming. See, the whole thing of idolatry comes down to some point of, what do we trust in those times of crisis? What do we trust? What is it we really trust? Now, see, we don't have problems with idols, other gods as such, in that sense of Old Testament. But what are our idols today? What is it that our security is in? What do we trust in? You know, is that retirement fund? Is it the government bailout program? Is it this? Is it that? What is our trust in? And you look around the nation and you see a great deal of trust in various things. Those become idols. That's what the security's in. And we're called back to, do we trust in Yahweh? And this book is not a revelation to tell us about history, but it uses history to tell us about the true God. Will you stand with me as we conclude? And Father, we thank you so much for your book of truth, your book of revelation, your book of history, your book of disclosure about yourself. For without your revelations, we would not know who you are. We could know of you from creation, but we wouldn't know who you are apart from your revelation. We pray that you might help us to walk with you in integrity of heart. And we do pray in Christ's name. Amen.